I've had the blonde roast, I've had the dark roast, I've even had the Brazilian too, but none of those roasts come close to you, 'cause I like you a latte. I've had the tall shot, vouched for the short shot, Italiano dreams came through, but none of those shots come close to you, 'cause I like you a latte.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3.3, the October 11th, 2023 Sweater Weather Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Well, that certain chill is in the air, and for me, nothing is better at this time of year than a freshly brewed cup of coffee first thing in the morning. I'm really not that much of a sweater guy myself, more of a sweatshirt person, you might say. There's a certain coziness to a nice merino wool hoodie, making it still possible to take that morning coffee outside and enjoy the coolness of the breeze. Soon enough, though, the breezes will turn to winds, and the coolness will become downright cold. So make sure to enjoy the remaining autumn temperatures while they last. And speaking of cool and chill, the cool chill sounds of jazz will soon be floating over Fredonia as the Fredonia Jazz Society's 2023 version of the Fredonia Jazz Festival will be taking the stages around Fredonia for a 3-day concert Thursday through Saturday, October 19th through 21st, featuring a diverse collection of jazz styles. I hit up Dr. Carl Bolter, one of the Fredonia Jazz Society's board members and a prime mover in creating the festival, to get the lowdown on this year's event. I'm joined now by an old colleague and friend from SUNY Fredonia. He is Carl Bolter. He is professor and director emeritus of the School of Music over at SUNY Fredonia. He is a composer himself, and most importantly for our purposes right now, he's on the board of directors of the Fredonia Jazz Society, and their jazz festival is coming October 19th through 21st, and we're all looking forward to that. So, Carl, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Great to see you.
Yeah, and it's great to see you and have you on the program. Magnificent. Now, let's get right into it. The Jazz Society has been around for a while, and I know that during the pandemic, it sort of had to take a little break, and this festival is sort of it's coming back now in full force. But why don't you give us a little bit of a background and history about how the Fredonia Jazz Society got started?
Yeah, so I've always really loved the jazz club environment. So if I'm traveling somewhere, like going like in New York City, going to see the Blue Note and spending some time and really enjoying the dynamic nature of jazz. I'm not a jazz musician myself. I'm a classical composer, an avant-garde composer from the 1970s, you know. So, but I've always dabbled in jazz, and the idea of having something like this in Fredonia, I thought would be a good idea. So the university hired a new colleague, Nick Weiser, who was a specialist in jazz. He's fantastic. I knew it the moment I heard him, and I thought, maybe this is our jazz club. I talked to my girlfriend about it, and she says, yeah, I think you have your jazz club. So Nancy and I walked all over Fredonia trying to find a place where this could be. And I walked into Domus Fair, thought this would be a good place. They were interested, kind of. I walked all over town again trying to find other places maybe that would work. And I came back to Domus Fair and said, I'm sorry, guys, you're it. The best place, the right size, the right acoustic, a restaurant that was functioning on its own. And all needed to do was be able to have permission to come in and turn it into a nightclub once in a while. So four nights a year, Jazz at Domosphere, it's been a hit. It generally sells out, and Nick Weiser has played there a lot. He is our artistic advisor, so sometimes he has ideas of who we could bring as a guest. Sometimes I have ideas who to bring as a guest, and we work collaboratively to try to develop a really interesting program with a lot of variety to it. So every event is different. It's been fun. Then in spring of 21, pardon me, September of 21, I said, let's do an outdoor jazz festival. So that was our effort to try to keep something going during the pandemic. We're coming kind of coming out of the pandemic, but not really. You know, it was still a time when people were nervous about being indoors. So the outdoor festival was the concept. And it was great as well, although it rained. So the last event had to go indoors anyway. So last year, 2022, we didn't have one. And now in 2023, we're doing it again, but having learned lessons, it's indoors.
So let's get down to some of the things that are going to be happening on the festival. You've got 3 days. You've got the 19th, you've got the Thursday the 19th, Friday the 20th, and Saturday the 21st, and a whole rundown of artists. Let's start with the 19th. You've got the Nick Finzer Quartet coming in, and I think Nick is your headliner for that night. Give us a little bit of an idea of what Nick does. He's a composer, award-winning composer, arranger, producer, and he's got quite a quartet.
Yeah. So Nick Finzer, he's a trombonist, and as you said, he's an arranger and composer. He is a new professor at University of North Texas. He has, through his connections, he's also a graduate of Eastman School of Music in Rochester. And so Nick Weiser knows Nick Finzer and vice versa. So that was one of the connections that was able to make. I think Nick Finzer has been here before working with students in a workshop. But so Nick has traveled the world. Nick Finzer has traveled the world with his work, and he has all these connections. So when I contacted Nick Finzer about joining us for the festival, one thing I said is, I'm looking for a quartet that would be diverse. So he says, I had this Cuban-born bassist. I had this pianist who was born in Japan, and I have this drummer, TJ Reddick, who is this new hot stuff out of Juilliard School of Music. How's that? I said, you're hired. Yeah, they are really great, and Nick Finzer is really at the top of his game. Early in his career, these are young people. Early in the career. Each of them are going to be developing names for themselves. They already have, of course, but you're going to be hearing more about them in years to come. So come and be part of this when they're on the upside of their career.
Now, your Friday lineup is really the Alumni Jazz Band and the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra, which is going to be at the Rausch Recital Hall on the SUNY Fredonia campus out in Mason Hall, and that's going to be a nice free concert. What are we going to hear there?
The Alumni Jazz Band, of course, are those people that I talked about earlier who are graduates of SUNY Fredonia, who were part of this student association jazz group. They are rightfully proud of themselves. And they come together once a year and do this concert. And they are really great. And of course, they have all kinds of experience behind them. They're all professional musicians in some way in their careers. So they have all this playing background. They come and play really hard. And because they are the original students in jazz, they take a certain amount of ownership of the new students. So they want to become mentors of the young kids. And the young kids really appreciate that as well. So to have them both on the same program is a nice thing. So I'm not sure if we're going to start with the Alumni Jazz Band and go to the Jazz Orchestra or other way around. But on this concert, you get to hear the early graduates and you get to hear the current undergraduates on the same program. And neither one's going to disappoint you. As I said earlier, the student jazz orchestra is now award-winning. So they play their socks off, too.
Okay, so let's go to the last night, the Saturday lineup, and we've got a whole lot of stuff going on here. In the afternoon, I know the Fredonia Opera House is going to have a whole smorgasbord of jazz performers. I think I'm going to be there taking tickets and stuff like that. But you've got the Morgan Street Stompers doing classic Dixieland. You've got a young singer by the name of Deanna Witkowski doing a tribute to Mary Lou Williams. Local legend Dave Galando with his saxophone is going to be there, as well as David Jonathan and the Inner City Bedlam. You want to give us a brief, like, 1, 2, 3, 4 downbeat here, or what?
Sure. Yeah. Well, obviously, 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, there are four things going on. So the downbeat is, of course, the Dixieland group, and so they start at noon. At the opera. Everything on Saturday is at the Opera House, by the way. So
on Saturday afternoon, right.
Everything on Saturday, period, is at the Opera House.
Oh, that's right. On Saturday, yeah. Period. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Dixieland starts at noon. Seemed like a good way to start it. Mm. And of course, as I was saying earlier, as much variety as possible is what we want to be able to have. So the Morgan Street Stompers is a group that's led by John Bacon, who is a drummer that we all know around Fredonia because he teaches here, he plays all the time, he's at Domus Fair all the time, he teaches the students at SUNY Fredonia drums and jazz, and he's really a strong leader in the Buffalo jazz scene. The Morgan Street Stompers was started by his father.
Wow.
So this has been going on for a while.
Yeah, so passing the baton.
Yeah, no, I think it's great, and the fact that John is willing to carry on this legacy is all the more powerful to the idea of bringing them here and having them start the program. Then Deanna Witkowski is a pianist. She does singing as well, but she's a pianist, and she's doing a tribute to Mary Lou Williams, who during the 30s and 40s was a major player in the jazz scene and a mentor to all these other musicians. And Deanna has done research on Mary Lou Williams, has published an award-winning book on the subject, and she's probably related to this, a candidate for a doctoral degree from the University of Pittsburgh in jazz studies. So she is probably the most noted authority on this, on Mary Lou Williams and the style of music from that period of time. It's going to be a performance, but she's going to be able to bring in examples, some backstory, some context to some of these things. So it's going to be an insightful thing to do, especially following some Dixieland. And then after that, there was a group in the 70s called Super Sax. Super Sax was a big hit, and what Super Sax did is they took Charlie Parker solos and arranged these solos for a bank of saxes. So it was just a big sax sound doing this, the gymnastics and virtuosic licks as a group, and. Yeah, it's lots of fun. It's a big sound. It's a big idea, and it was a big hit. So Dave Galando, as a saxophonist, has taken some of this literature and is placing them on some saxophonists he knows. So it's going to be a lineup of five saxes in front of the stage, performing some super sax stuff. So this is called Dave Galando's Sax Time.
It's great.
Yeah,
that's great.
So the afternoon finishes with David Jonathan's Inner City Bedlam. They are an established group out of Buffalo, They turned jazz a little bit toward the modern, more to the rock side. And a lot of them are singers. David Jonathan himself is a drummer, and he leads the group. But it's a big group. You know, it's a big setup. So it's going to be a lot of sound. It's going to be a lot of fun. And if you want to wake up, this group will do it.
Yeah, yeah. So you could go out, then get a little dinner someplace, maybe at Domus Fair, who knows? And then after you've done that, you're going to come back for the headliner. And she is something else. I've listened to some of her performances on YouTube. She's a singer. She's a composer. She's a pianist. She's got a lot going on for her. Nicole Zoraitis, I believe, and her quartet coming
Correct.
On.
Correct. Yeah, so... the evening concert is the headliner. It's Nicole Zoraitis for sure, and her quartet. Looking for a diverse group. So we have Nicole's guitarist, was born in Israel, and he has a guitar sound that kind of crosses over between jazz and maybe some like 60s, 70s rock and roll guitar sounds. No, it's a very sophisticated, well thought out sound he's created, and that's one of the things that's his trademark is his sound, and the drummer, who I believe is Nicole's husband, Dan Pugach, works with Nicole in developing some of these arrangements that she does, and Dan runs a 9-piece group called the Dan Pugach Nonet, for which he writes these arrangements. And it is for these arrangements that Nicole and Dan have been Grammy nominated. A really fine group. And there are some clips about Dan Pugach's Nonet out there online, and you can check it out. But it's a great thing. The show is at 7, and the opening act for the show is the Nick Weiser Sextet.
Ah, good.
So I want to make sure that's understood, that for this evening concert, it's kind of a big event because it's Nick Weiser's sextet, 6 people, followed by Nicole and her quartet, 4 people. And you can expect that the delineation between those two groups will begin to erase a little bit during the course of the event. Let me also add that the afternoon showcase ends at 5. The evening concert begins at 7. So there is a 2-hour window. So if you're going to come to everything, which I hope everybody will, one could say, oh, what am I going to do for dinner? So I'm working with the Harvest Moon Festival, which is also happening the very same weekend. The Village of Fredonia is going to be pretty busy on the 21st.
Yeah. But,
yeah. So the Harvest Moon Festival is happening in the Parker Commons right outside the Opera House. And they will have food vendors and other kind of vendors there in the Commons. Those food vendors have agreed to stay on until 7 o'clock. So they'll be available for people to go out and get a bite to eat. The two organizations are getting a tent to put up, so in case it gets dark, cold, windy, whatever, you know, a place to go and to sit down and eat your dinner in comfort, and then make sure you get back to the concert in time. Because if you go out to eat at a restaurant, which we all, you know, want to have you do as well, you're worried about, can I get back on time?
Right.
And this takes care of that situation.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Carl, it sounds like a tremendous 3 days of music and just an awful lot of fun. Let me commend you on the diversity, the different kinds of styles of music that are coming in, from Dixieland to jazz infused with gospel soul, getting a big headliner like Nicole, Grammy-nominated artist. It's really very impressive, Carl. So we all look forward to taking as much part of it as we can.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks so much.
You're very, very welcome. So good luck to you, and I'll probably see you Saturday night somewhere, Saturday afternoon in the Opera House when I'm sitting there scanning tickets.
Sounds good. I'll be watching for you.
All right, Carl. Thanks for coming on. Okay. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Tickets for the Fredonia Jazz Festival can be obtained on the Fredonia Jazz Society's website, www.fredoniajazzsociety.com. You can purchase an all-festival pass for $100, which will get you into all the concerts over the 3 days, or you can purchase tickets individually for each event. Please take note that, although all of Saturday, October 21st's events will take place in the Opera House, the Opera House box office is not selling tickets. You must purchase all tickets through the Jazz Society's website. The Friday, October 20th alumni concert at Rausch Recital Hall is the only free event on the program. Tong Shepherd Duo will be presenting a concert of chamber music entitled Fantasies to Fairy Tales on Wednesday, October 25th, beginning at 7 p.m. in the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Consisting of violinist Jessica Tong and pianist Michael Shepherd, the duo has been acclaimed for their unique and vibrant approach to the chamber music repertoire. I had a chance to squeeze in a discussion with violinist Jessica Tong in between her many commitments as a teacher and performer this fall. I'm very excited and pleased to have with me now one half of the Tong Shepherd Duo. She is Jessica Tong. She is assistant professor of violin at SUNY Fredonia, and she is one very, very busy musician, as she has many other projects that she does. And giving us the time to do this particular concert at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House is going to be a treat. So, Jessica, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Now, one of the things I really like to do when I'm talking to musicians in particular, or any artist really, is to sort of get their background. Like, I'm fascinated by how it is that artists pick up the particular art form that they've got. And you decided to become a violinist. So where did all that come from? How did you first get interested in the violin? What's the background there?
Sure.
What's the backstory?
So I would say it's a little bit of a funny story because I didn't actually start off as a violinist. Actually, at the age of 2.5, I saw somebody playing the piano. And when my parents asked me if I ever wanted to try an instrument, my first response was I wanted to play the biggest possible instrument to their chagrin. And I asked them if they would invest in a piano for me. So I started on the piano very young and really loved it. But what happened was when I was about 5, I happened to go to Japan with my family on a trip, and they took me to meet Dr. Suzuki. I don't know if people might know, but he was a very, very famous pedagogue who's really reached worldwide with his methodology. But at the time, Dr. Suzuki was still alive when I went to Matsumoto, and I got to meet him in person as a child. And his incredible warmth and ebullience and just his love for music and for other people just struck me so vividly, even at that age, that when I came home, I said to my mom, I really want to start playing violin as well. And so for a long time, I actually played both piano and violin until at some point you just have to decide which one you, because there are only so many hours in the day.
Exactly.
And what ended up happening was because I actually really cultivated a love for chamber music, playing with others, and piano can get quite lonely at times. So that was kind of an impetus of why I ended up choosing the violin and pursuing it as a career.
Yes, I noticed that. I did notice that chamber music seems to be the kind of music you really enjoy playing. Were there particular composers of chamber music that really got you started in that direction rather than orchestral music?
I mean, I think it's the nature of chamber music, and particularly string quartets in my case, was that there is something about it that when you're playing with other people, you are still a part of a greater whole, and yet you're really only one on a part, so there is a large sense of responsibility there, and that kind of balance between the two and the resultant music making that occurred of having something beyond what you could individually accomplish, those things kind of really drew me into this small ensemble art form. If I were to say bucket list composers or desert island composers that I love off the top of my head, really without thinking, I mean, Mozart and Schubert usually come to mind. Of their string quartets are some of my very favorite. But I really do love a wide variety and of all sorts of eras and genres.
So let me ask you, as I mentioned at the top of the interview, you are one half of the Tong Shepherd duo. Michael Shepherd is the pianist who's going to accompany you. And unfortunately, at the time of this recording, we couldn't get him on the podcast because I believe he's in Brazil. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you and Michael formed a duo together to play the many concerts you've played?
So Michael and I happened to be at Peabody at the same time. He had already graduated, but he had been playing with a lot of different people there when I was studying. And I had asked him if he would play a Mozart sonata with me. And, you know, it's like one of those things where the moment you start playing together, it clicks and there's a lot of chemistry. And we really loved playing together. And for many years, we continued to play occasionally with one another. It also helps that we came from very similar musical backgrounds, not only the same schools, but he studied with Leon Fleischer and I studied with Pam Frank at Peabody, who were very similar in their own approaches of music making. So it almost felt like even though I had only met him, he could finish my musical sentences and vice versa when we were playing together. And then, you know, as time went on and I entered the professional world, you know, and started getting concerts and recitals, he was always somebody in the forefront of my mind because we were such great collaborators. And so we started playing together regularly every year. And so every year, even though we both have careers that take us in very different places in many ways throughout the year, we always come together and have one or two programs that we take on tour about a couple times each season.
Now, you also have so many other projects going on. You are working at a place called the Avalanche Farm Music Institute. You've done music beyond the chamber down in Vero Beach, Florida. And all of this is part of your interest in music education. What is it that drives you to give so much to these young musicians that you work with at all of these particular places where you're the artistic director in a couple of them?
Yeah, well, I think so much of what has formed me as a musician comes from those who were my mentors back in the day. And it's a way to pay it forward to another generation, as well as to offer other young musicians opportunities that I didn't always have when I was younger. I think it's really important for the 21st, we are in the 21st century, right? 21st
yes,
century, 21st century musician. You know, not only to be good at their art form, but really to be an advocate for what we do. I think that's increasingly important nowadays, because I do think arts and the music are as important as ever, but don't always have the platform. So it's been really important to me to help found or run a lot of these organizations to bring opportunities for expression for many, many other musicians.
I've watched some of your YouTube performances, and you really get into it. you have a flourish and a way of moving that is really very energetic. And you've mentioned before in your bios that the mind-body connection in performance is something you are extremely interested. You've wound up yoga into that, and so on and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that mind-body connection, what you see there as a performer when you're playing, and how it affects the way you approach your music?
Sure. Well, I mean, the way that I ended up getting interested in this was perhaps somewhat by fluke. I went to a music festival called Tanglewood many, many years ago, and I was a fellow there when I was a student. And right across the street from Tanglewood was one of the biggest, I guess, yoga retreat centers in America called Kripalu. And I was part of some initial group that they did a joint test where you got to take yoga classes and certain mindfulness classes there while you were also a fellow at Tanglewood. And that kind of piqued my curiosity. And I'll be totally honest, the first time I went to a yoga class, I do remember, I saw everybody looking so calm and so zen, and all I could think about was, man, I hope nobody tows my car while I'm in my yoga class. And after 90 minutes of being fixated on that in a class, I realized, man, I probably actually do need to be able to kind of bring my focus to whatever I'm doing at the time, because ultimately that's fundamentally what music is about. It's about being present to listening and reacting to what you're doing. So, you know, that led me to explore a lot of different mediums beyond just yoga. Like I said, like meditation and Alexander technique, and to kind of see what might be able to help us not only play more efficiently and play more naturally, but also to find more ergonomic ways of moving and expressing ourselves through our instruments. Because if you, let's face it, fundamentally, playing the violin or most musical instruments is not actually a natural thing.
Right.
And I would say in the last 20, 30 years that I've seen, I think there is finally starting to be a recognition of how physical playing an instrument actually is. Many people don't think of, you know, musicians as being athletes, but it really is about being an athlete of small muscle groups. And I would just ask somebody who doesn't think so to tilt their head to the side and hold it there and see what happens if you did that for 8 hours over 30 years and see what that might do to your posture. And so we don't really think about that. And for a long time, actually, it was very taboo to talk about injuries and issues like that. And so I think there is more acceptance, there's much more awareness. And I think that was something that really resonated with me in my own personal journey too.
So finally, I want to ask you a little bit just about the program for the 25th, when you and Michael will be playing. You've got four pieces that I see. Can you talk a little bit about each piece just very, very quickly, why you chose to pick them, and what are we looking forward to?
Sure. So the whole program is entitled Fantasies and Fairy Tales. So you can imagine that there's probably a commonality in that they all have to do with fantasies. You know, the Fantasia came about around the Baroque era, and rather than a particular form of piece, it represented a little bit more of a free form, improvisatory kind of work, and was loosely applied to a lot of different styles of music that had that improvisatory nature. It's an interesting progression in this program where you have it take on the idea of a fantasy take on very different forms. In the Schumann, they're actually very short character pieces that Schumann wrote originally for clarinet and piano that are transcribed for violin and piano, but take on kind of the characters of the fictional characters that he often wrote about, Florestan and Eusebius. In the Gershwin, which was actually, it's actually, this piece is written by a Russian composer called Igor Frolov, who took all of the Gershwin tunes from Porgy and Bess and turned it into basically a beautiful, fun showpiece of all of the greatest hits of this Gershwin masterpiece. In the Szymanowski, it's not quite a fantasy, but the piece is called Myths, and it's three short pieces based off of Greek mythology. And what was great about it was that it's a departure from the very traditional Germanic Western classical music, and it started to become much more impressionistic and expressionistic in its style and timbre and its harmonic language. And even though it's still very accessible, he really uses a lot of extended techniques, and at the time that was very, very unusual to depict all sorts of different mythological creatures. And then the Schubert fantasy is kind of, I would just say, it's one of the great masterpieces of violin and piano playing. And unlike the Schumann, it is epic in nature in every possible way. It starts off with these quiet tremolos and incredibly long lines where time just completely stands still, and then followed by seven interwoven sections of a set of variations on a theme that he had written as part of a lied, Sei mir gegrüßt. And it is really free form in that it doesn't follow any traditional kind of sonata allegro form that almost all pieces had, but it almost seems like everything just seems very rhapsodic and evolves very organically and gradually until you come back to this opening theme at the end and you see how much you've evolved in your life from beginning to end of the piece.
Wonderful. It really does sound like a very, very exciting program. And I'm sure the listeners will be thrilled to be able to come and listen to these very many varied pieces. Jessica Tong, thank you ever so much for coming on the program. And we look forward to the Tong Shepherd Duo Concert on Wednesday, October 25th at 7 p.m. And good luck with your travels. Be careful out there. And hopefully you'll make it back from all of them safely to perform for us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jessica. Bye-bye. The Tong Shepherd Duo's concert, Fantasies to Fairy Tales, will take place on Wednesday, October 25th, beginning at 7 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults, $13 for Opera House members, and $5 for students. You can purchase tickets by calling the box office at 716-679-1891 or online at www.fredopera.org. Please note that the concert is being performed on a Wednesday evening as opposed to our usual Friday evening dates for live performances. Here is the arts calendar for the upcoming 2 weeks. The Claudette Sorrell visiting artist, Dr. Valerie Coleman, an internationally renowned composer, will be in residence at the Fredonia School of Music from Thursday, October 12th through Saturday, October 14th. She will be participating in a roundtable symposium on Thursday, offering master classes, and concerts of her chamber music will be performed by Fredonia faculty and the Fredonia College Symphony. Please see the Fredonia School of Music website for complete details about her residency. The Fredonia Trombone Ensemble will perform Monday, October 16th at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. guest artist Tony Caramina will perform a concert entitled Piano Potpourri on Thursday, October 16th in the Rausch Recital Hall. The Ecstasis Duo, with Natasha Farney on cello and Eliran Avni on piano, will perform on Sunday, October 22nd at 3 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. The Woodwind Chamber Ensemble will perform on Tuesday, October 24th at 8 p.m., followed by the Clarinet Ensemble on Wednesday, October 25th at 8 p.m. Both of these concerts are in the Rausch Recital Hall. And as always, admission to all School of Music events is free and open to the public. And finally, the Fredonia Opera House Cinema Series will be presenting the movie A Haunting in Venice, featuring Kenneth Branagh as Agatha Christie's iconic detective Hercule Poirot. The film will be screened on Saturday, October 14th, and again on Tuesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. each night. Tickets can be purchased at the door only and are $7 for adults, $6.50 for seniors and members, and $5 for students. And please remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, send us an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information.
Good evening, Pierre. Studying?
Yes. How was the opera?
Lovely. Natalia Rostova was there.
Oh. Oh, dear Andrei is betrothed. I have known her family for years and long carried affection for her.
Yes. Charming. Look, Dolokhov's coming round, and we're off to the club. Will you come, old man?
I will come.
Lend me 50 rubles.
Drink, drink, gonna drink tonight, gonna drink tonight. Gonna drink, gonna drink tonight. Gonna drink tonight, gonna drink, drink. Gonna drink tonight, gonna drink tonight. Gonna drink, gonna drink tonight. Gonna drink tonight, gonna drink tonight.
You would never think that an epic novel such as War and Peace would ever have any chance of being turned into a musical. But that's just what composer David Malloy did with a small section of the famous Tolstoy masterpiece. The Department of Theater and Dance will be presenting Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, beginning on Friday, October 20th. And I spoke with director Dr. Jessica Hillman McCord about this unusual and inventive musical. Joining me now to talk about the upcoming musical at the Department of Theater and Dance is Dr. Jessica Hillman McCord. She is professor of theater and dance at the department at SUNY Fredonia, and she is the director of Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. Welcome, Jessica, to the podcast.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So in looking at this particular musical that you and the department have chosen to produce, there are so many aspects of it that, in a sense, I don't quite know where to start. I think the first thing is sort of to give the listeners an idea of what this musical is, because it's not exactly a title like, Camelot or Guys and Dolls or any of those things that most people would be immediately familiar with. It's not an obscure musical, but by the same token, it really didn't catch the popular imagination. So let's talk a little bit about its history and its background.
Sure. It doesn't have the name recognition of something like a Golden Age piece like Camelot. It is a recent musical, and it was a pretty big hit in a lot of ways, maybe not as commercially as much of it as perhaps the producers wanted, but it really did catch a lot of imagination and a lot of excitement when it was on Broadway. It actually started off Broadway in Ars Nova, a small off-Broadway producing house, and then it actually had a really unique life on its way to Broadway. I don't think when they first wrote it, anyone expected it to go to Broadway, but because it was such an exciting piece, it really took a journey. It went to a tent downtown, and then another tent in Midtown Manhattan, then to ART in Boston, and then to Broadway. And along the way, it grew bigger and bigger and more exciting. I think what's super unique about it is that it's really immersive. It's a production that takes place all around you, and we've really changed the layout in the Marvel Theater in order to make that happen. And it is it's sung through pop opera. I think the official kind of term that gets used is a sung through electro pop opera, which I guess describes what it is. It's hard. The music is so unique. It has really just beautiful musical theater music that feels like it's from Les Miserables, and then it has like club techno moments, and then it has kind of Russian folk music. It's got like a Beyonce kind of pop music. It's really got everything all combined in one. So yeah, I'm also going all over the place because there's so many things to talk about here. What I didn't say there is that it's based on a little slice of War and Peace by Tolstoy. Not the whole book. That does not cover the epic of War and Peace. It's just a tiny little 70-page part of it that is in the middle in book two of War and Peace. And it's really just a character-driven story about these two characters, Tasha and Pierre, who ultimately connect in the end of the piece.
Yeah, I was particularly fascinated by it. I mean, the first thing I did when I did my research was say War and Peace. That is really something to create a musical about Tolstoy. But, you know, I did see a lot of connection between the and I know the connections are loose, but it's sort of the same thing where Hamilton by Lin-Manuel Miranda took a story set in obviously in colonial America, but attached a lot of modern style music, hip hop, so on and so forth. And this particular musical almost does exactly the same thing in terms of giving the audience something to listen to that's very, very contemporary, but at the same time really pays homage to the kinds of classical music that were prevalent in Russia and Russian folk songs and so on. So there's this interesting fusion between what the past would have looked like in 1812 in Russia and what the present tense provides for the musical in terms of both music style and characterizations and just about everything.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think Hamilton's an interesting comparison because this was actually doing it first, but they were in and around the same time creating these worlds where I think a lot of, well, not a lot, but several modern musicals are kind of playing with this anachronistic idea of history and modernity sort of in the same pieces. There's a clash of it, but it's a really fun and exciting and vibrant kind of clash. For instance, all the period characters, that sort of the principal characters are in period dress, but then the ensemble are in kind of a mix of 80s Russian punk and Russian folk costumes. There's a club scene where they would go to a club in 1812, but it's really like a modern kind of techno club. So it really does play with time and history and what it means. When I think part of the reason of doing that, and I think part of what makes it so compelling is because when we think of War and Peace or Hamilton or any of these kind of historical things as being dusty or old or boring, and it really makes them of the moment and vibrant and kind of grabs you in a way that people might not, you know, people would be afraid to go see a musical of War and Peace, but that this is not a straight ahead adaptation of War and Peace. It's much more compelling.
When we talk about the complexity of the plot a little bit, I don't know if you can actually make it simple for us because there's so many characters, they interact so much, but it's sort of kind of basically a love story gone wrong.
The opening piece says It's a complicated Russian novel. Everyone has 9 different names. So look it up in your program. We appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Those are the lyrics. So we literally have a family tree in the program, which makes it sound like it's hard to follow. I don't think it is actually at all once you're watching it. It ultimately, there's 2 kind of intersecting lines. Pierre is sort of searching for meaning. He has an unfaithful wife. There's a duel. So that's another Hamilton comparison. So there's that piece. And then there's Natasha, who is engaged to be married, but then kind of gets her head turned by a dashing kind of bad guy. And then they plan to elope and then gets caught. And at the end, Natasha and Pierre meet in the very last piece of the entire show. They finally meet, and ultimately in War and Peace later on they go on to be married, but at that moment it's just sort of the possibility of a new life and a change. So we have basically these 2 stories of these 2 major characters and what happens from there, and all the supporting characters are really vibrant and fun and interesting, but it isn't hard to follow the way you might be afraid of in a Russian novel. I think the music makes it pretty clear.
I found an incredible amount of parallel in the plot and the characters to a lot of Anton Chekhov's work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That same kind of Russian aristocracy, that sort of, you know, kind of bored and looking for, you know, various things to keep themselves busy while their lives sort of crumble around them, you know, very, very of that period. And Tolstoy was, I think, an influence on Chekhov.
No, 100%. And we've been saying in rehearsal, this musical has a combination of these huge production numbers with crazy dances and club lights and everything. And then many scenes that really feel like they're out of a Chekhov play, only they happen to be sung instead of spoken, but it's very Chekhovian in some ways, at the same time as being, you know, Beyonce influenced. So it's a really very vast combination of influences for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like wonderful fusion stuff, and I mean it has, you know, I think something for everyone. Like if you're a young person, you're going to love the music and the way that the music sort of excites itself. If you have that background of, you know, this kind of Russian literature, then, you know, someone like me would really be captivated by it. Now talk a little bit about the set itself. I know when it opened first at Ars Nova, it was very small. It was very intimate. And the audience was practically part of the whole set. What have you done with the Marvel Theater to sort of incorporate this concept?
Yeah, it is. From its very beginnings, was meant to be an immersive experience. Dave Malloy, who wrote it, had an experience when he went to Russia of sitting in a supper club where there were musicians scattered about the room. And he had this like really interesting experience sitting next to the viola and felt like, you know, and then they were given black bread and dumplings and given shakers and they sort of took part in it. So in the DNA of the piece, they always felt like this is an immersive show that the audience is part of. And then as they brought that into Off-Broadway and Broadway, they did it in different ways, but audience seated on the stage and or acting out in the house, really just sort of changing the traditional relationship of an audience facing a, you know, fourth wall kind of proscenium stage. We really do away with that entirely. They did that in small rooms and then kept changing, like where did it in tents, etc. We have this proscenium stage and we have to figure out how to do that. Because it was very important to me that we keep the immersive experience of it. So we have our traditional stage, but there are some audience seated on the traditional stage. And then we have a thrust. So we sort of built the stage out into the house, similar to Spring Awakening, if you remember that. But then mm-hmm. we also put satellite stages in the house. So we have 2 little platforms right in the middle of the seating sections. And then a lot of the action takes place in the aisles too. So it is definitely, definitely not a traditional theater experience where you just sit and facing one direction and watch, which I think is sometimes scary to people, but we do it in a really, I think, a very inviting and non-threatening kind of way. We actually are going to have like bracelets for people who welcome audience interaction. And then for people who don't want to be kind of in the action, they can definitely just have the experience where they just watch. But if you want to have a different theater experience where you're not just kind of what Peter Brook called deadly theater, where you just kind of sit there and get bored and have your dinner and your evening out, and then you go and you forget about it. It's much more visceral and exciting, and it's so much more compelling to me that way. I think we see a fair amount of theater that's just, you know, fine and fun, but this is something new, and that's I find particularly exciting. And I think it's a really great experience for the whole crew, the actors, everyone, to have this experience when working in a different way. So the action is in and around everyone.
That's exciting.
Actually. Yeah, it is exciting. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. One final question I want to ask you. The title, of course, includes the Great Comet of 1812, but it doesn't seem to really make an appearance until the very last number, I believe, when Pierre manages to see it go across the sky and sings about it. What was it about the Comet of 1812 that made it so particularly special that it had to be included in the title?
It's basically symbolic of Pierre has been searching and searching for meaning or of the sort of the point of his life. And he's just had this encounter with Natasha, and then he sees it in the sky, and he says, some people found it frightening, and some people in that period thought it was, you know, a terrifying sign of the end of the world. But for him, it signifies new life, a new chance, a new beginning. And Natasha's had this, I don't want to give it all away, but she's had a terrible experience. And so she has a possibility of a new life here with him as well. He has a possibility of new life, and that comet, this kind of this life-changing moment, is symbolized by the comet and all the possibilities of what the comet could mean. And so it's very it's a beautiful moment, and it's a really I think it's moving. This musical does everything, but the it's moving, it's exciting, it's crazy, it's fun, it's all those things. And then the end with the comet, I think it's really brings it all together in a very moving way for these characters. And and I think it's going to be a really beautiful visual moment too, because we have going to have a really, I don't want to give it away again, but we have a really beautiful moment with the theatrically there.
Okay. Yeah, that does it. That says it. It's going to be a wonderful theatrical moment. That's all you need to say.
That's right.
Well, I have to give you credit for choosing a musical like this that has all of these elements. I think that's especially valuable for the students to take on something as complex as this, introducing us to, you know, something other than the old familiars. It's always good to get something on the stage and see it. And I really encourage people to go out and take a listen to it, because it's going to be something that will be unique. And being in the theater, really, hopefully, the more we get it to be a unique and interesting experience, the more people will show up.
Exactly. I think I just want to encourage people, because sometimes you hear either War and Peace, or you hear audience interaction, or you hear electro pop, or any of those things that might scare people away. I would really encourage people to take the leap, because it really is, I think, going to be a very theatrical and exciting and moving kind of experience to have.
Yep, and I'm going to encourage them to do the same thing. Great. Jessica, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. And good luck with the rest of it. I mean, I know it's you're getting towards the end, and it always gets a little tense, but I'm sure you guys will be able to pull it off.
That's right. The students are wonderful. They really are. They're doing a great job. So I feel confident that people will enjoy it.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you very much. We'll see you there.
Thank you.
Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812 will open on Friday, October 20th at 7:30 p.m. in the Robert Marvel Theater at the Rockefeller Arts Center. Additional performances will take place on Saturday, October 21st, Thursday, October 26th, Friday, October 27th, and Saturday, October 28th, all at 7:30 p.m. with a matinee performance on Sunday, October 22nd at 2 p.m. Tickets are available by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. And that's it for this sweater weather edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Carl Bolter, Jessica Tong, and Jessica Hillman McCord for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891. Visit the website at www.fredopera.org or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available everywhere you can get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, October 25th, 2023. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.